This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, what's new? Happy New Year.
Yeah, well, I'm just wanting to know if Jen is frozen to death there in Virginia.
So far, so good. It's a lot warmer than it was a few weeks ago. We had a really nice little warm spell.
Uh-huh.
I was out planting my trees.
So, got it.
Yeah, it's been very good.
All right.
Now it's just more general winter weather.
So. Gotcha. Okay.
But California is the place not to be. You guys are the ones who are getting the unseasonable weather.
Yeah. Well,
What's the news call it? The bomb cyclone? Was that what it was called?
Atmospheric river is what I've heard. there's quite a few terms of art. Yes.
Yeah.
All of it highly unusual, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
you know what was creepy to me is I'm driving down the freeway last week, and there's a little the you know those government signs that say don't drink and drive and all these other things. It says very severe weather. Stay home and don't travel until Thursday night.
Huh.
And I'm like, it was like nothing. There was nothing different than normal rain, at least where I was. I'm sure I've seen some pictures and some videos of some little bit of flooding in areas, but it's just a little bit creepy with all the government control.
Slightly government creepy.
Yeah.
Well, especially when they control the weather too.
Yeah.
Well, just the thought that they were trying to tell us to stay home and don't be at home and there's no rain coming out. So
right now they got us all sensitized and paranoid now. So
yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah,
it's all very. I mean, we have been so completely habituated over the last couple of years to what does the government say that I can do today? Is it okay if I leave my house? Is it okay if I stand 4 feet close to you instead of 6 feet? We've become. Sort of mommied into like intense compliance. And so it's not at all surprising to see a sign like that, which, you wouldn't have seen that a few years
ago.
There would have been crappy weather and people would have exercised judgment. And, people would have been out in all weather to do whatever it is that they're doing. But there wouldn't have been this secondary sort of expectation that I'm gonna wait to see if it's okay if I go instead of just looking at the situation and making your own decision. Apart from a hurricane evacuation or something, that's always been the case.
Very true, actually. That's what hit Nathan's little creepy circuit. Yes, it
stay
should
safe.
Have.
Yeah, stay safe.
It's for your safety. Speaking of which, do you guys have any gas stoves in your house that you're using, or is
yeah,
this...
I know, but I'm starting to shop for one.
All right. Let's move on to what our questions.
Okay. Very good. All right, dear doctors, given that depression is inherently demotivating because it is failure feedback that tells you to stop doing what you're doing, how might one bootstrap oneself into more positive and motivated mood states? I wonder what people in the Stone Age village would have done to bounce back from failure feedback. It makes most of us want to curl into a ball and die. And how does depression actually end up benefiting and motivating us?
Well, I would say I'm just going to go ahead and take this because this is a
big overarching question about what depression is, what emotions are, what's going on there. So this is a sort of 101 sort of question. So go ahead and run with it, and I'll chime in as needed.
Gotcha. Okay. So what feelings are is feelings are feedback mechanisms to try to instruct you as to what to do. And so the an algorithm that's very useful to try to address any kind of clinical problem of any kind is going to transport yourself back to the Stone Age and see how things looked like then. So the overwhelming majority, not all, but the overwhelming majority of medical problems in the United States today are directly due to the differences between the Stone Age environment and the modern environment. So a whole bunch of it is diet, a bunch of it is smoking and drugs, medications, lack of sunlight, lack of exercise, lack of sleep. By the time you get rid of all of the drugs, all of the sleep deficiency secondary to the electric light bulb and media, and all of the exercise deficiencies related to the sedentary potential of a modern lifestyle, and all of the processed food, then you're going to eliminate almost all of the physical problems that you see. So that's kind of interesting to notice that. So then secondarily, we can look at something that might look like long-term chronic depression, and we would wonder if such a thing would be typical in the Stone Age environment. And I would argue that that would be unlikely. And that would be because the depression, say a big failure feedback, for some reason could cause you to pull your horns in and not take any chances and not essentially take your best solution. So if you were trapped in, you know, oh, I don't know, in the Titanic and you were going down and you had been handcuffed to a pipe. Okay. Then, and you got your girlfriend there with a hatchet, you know, it's like you take your best shot. That's what you have to do. You don't have any choice. And so in the Stone Age, you can't crawl up in a ball and die. You're crawling up in a ball and dying in the modern environment, i.e. that's what you feel like doing. But it's warm and cozy. You got air conditioner, you've got heating, you've got food in the refrigerator. It's like you don't have poverty and hunger that are forcing you to take the most effective action possible. And as a result, you're not getting any feedback from normal systems that would be telling you that you're being efficacious. And not only that, you can be crawling home in your apartment and shutting the phone off, and if you had any friends, and et cetera, and quote, dying. But the truth of the matter is that in the Stone Age village, you'd be in front of God and everybody. And whatever failure feedback that was causing your depression would be likely widely known by everybody. Okay? And so as a result, everybody could see and understand the causes of your depression. It would be marked on your forehead in like that. You know, if they're blind, they could read it in Braille anyway, just from listening to the sound of your voice. And so what's going to happen is that your friends are going to be attracted to that because they're going to see, or friends or other people in the village that think that they've got a solution. And they're going to be attracted to your misery because they're going to be esteem hunting and insurance poaching. In other words, it's like, hey, if I think you've got a problem that I think you can fix, then I'm going to give you a bunch of advice, because if it works or you come out of it, you'll attribute it maybe to me and then I get credit for it. And so, and the greater the degree of your misery, the greater the profit there is in for me to try to help you solve it. Now, so obviously there are limits to this. When you've got some deadbeat friend that's always in crisis, and this is the 18th time since grad school that you ran into this with her, and then you may not want to take her phone call, okay? So you've determined that this is not a temporary and unstable situation, that this is a permanent and chronic situation, and now you've run a CB on rejecting her little squally depressive, you know, signals that are telling you that that she's in trouble and she could probably really use some help. But for most people, most of the time, most of the depression would be understandable. People would make largely correct inferences because there's only a few domains of life that are going to drive this. It's mostly going to be romance and bad feedback and grief in that area. There, you could have been embarrassed by some expectation that you were supposed to do something well in the village and you blew it. You did a lousy job. But more or less, most of depression is going to be the result of it's mostly going to be the result of strife in interpersonal relationships of those closest to you. That's what it's going to be. Your mother doesn't like your choice of mate, and the two of them don't get along, and they're squabbling all the time, and it's big stress and all that. Okay, that's, you know, and then your mate leaves you because of that. Now you're depressed about it. Your mom's happy, but you're not. So, but one way or the other, you are not going to be isolated in the way that you can be now. And you are not going to be otherwise physically comfortable in the way that you are now. So you're going to be required to continue to do the things that are going to cause you to be out of literal physical threat and physical misery. And you will have to be interacting with other people along the way because you are a member of a Stone Age village and you're part of that effectively an economy. So that is going to cause you to continue to get bits of positive feedback for the little helpful things that you do during the day, so you're not going to be isolated from that. And those are going to be likely more important to you then and in those circumstances than just simply doing office work and moving paper from one stack to the other during the normal course of some business day. You're not going to get the same degree of positive esteem signaling from your contributions. It's going to be more perfunctory and more isolated here because we are not really that, we're not particularly interdependent here where you were extremely interdependent in the Stone Age. So that's...
And the work's not as important. It's not as...
Right.
It's not life and death for somebody else, or it's not making a huge difference in someone else. Most of the time, a lot of office work isn't. So, you know,
yes,
there's no immediate feedback of its...
Right. Exactly. So... Yeah, and so that is all that being put together, the value of depression is just like the value of any feeling, that it's a critically important signaling device to tell you what the deep cost benefit analytics machine has concluded, and it's concluded that you have experienced a loss and you were not able to be able to stop it or mitigate it, and you are feeling defeated in some way, and therefore you need to quit putting time and energy into that specific goal with that specific tactic. That's the important thing to get clear here. It doesn't stop you from taking action generally. It might in the modern environment only because you got money stored up and you've got a check coming for whatever, and you've got plenty of food in the refrigerator. But if you didn't, you would find that you would have to continue to take efficacious action and social psychologically effective action, and you would continue in those markets, and your successes there would be unabated. So all that you would have this specific interpersonal loss that you had experienced. But remember, everybody's going to know about it. So there's going to be no end of advice. And if you're some girl that just got dumped by the fancy guy, and now you're squalling and unhappy, well, guess who's going to be coming knocking on your door? Is going to be the second fanciest guy. You know, one notch below the guy you just lost. Who suddenly ears perk up like a Doberman, okay? Like, oh, you know, as Michael J. Fox said, I think when Tracy Pollard, that he had met her or whatever, and then she was with a boyfriend, and then he found out, I don't know, 18 months later that she had broken up, and he goes, oh, that's too bad. Where's the phone? Okay? So life and its dramas begin anew in the Stone Age in a way that we can insulate ourselves from these other processes in the modern environment and wind up with a longer grade of problem than the system was designed for. So I think that Jen and I think about, we do a time transport of a person's circumstances, go think back to the Stone Age and think, what's missing? What's out of balance? Okay. And what's missing and out of balance from somebody who's very depressed is likely that they may be some girl or guy that has now too many eggs in one basket with respect to a specific relationship that has now gone south, and now they're all miserable about it, which is fine, except that they may be remarkably isolated from normal esteem process elsewhere in the village, and therefore it's hitting them harder, and actually it's more emotionally disturbing than it would have been in the Stone Age. And I think that's probably true. Jen, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's the number of things that are inconsistent with Stone Age life and modern life that contribute to a state of depression are innumerable. I mean, we can just go on and on about these things. There's everything that you're describing. There's the general, just the way people are living life, the sort of embeddedness in a social community where you have a built-in sense of this is where I belong, these are my people, I am known, my emotional vicissitudes are not a big deal because I belong here. There's a sense of pride in what you contribute to village life. There is an ongoing source of distraction and occupation, so you don't have the kind of time to ruminate about things that mm-hmm. we do in the modern environment. I mean, I think the worst thing when you're feeling depressed is to have a lot of time where you're not very busy and you don't have much to do except sit around and ruminate about how depressed you are. That's sort of the antithesis of every bit of, you know, sort of old wives' tale type advice that you will find throughout the ages. I reread the Little House on the Prairie books not that long ago. there's all of Ma Ingalls kind of, well, you know, if it's not one thing, it's another, and it always will be, and just be thankful for what you have. You know, these sorts of these things that seem very callous to us now, mm-hmm. sort of like brush yourself off and get on with it. And, there's things to be done. We have to prepare for winter. We have to take care of business around the community and take care of each other, because if we don't do that, we're not going to survive, and you're not going to survive. So there's the immediate feedback of all of the things that you're describing, and there's also just this profoundly different social ecology mm-hmm. that it extends to things like artificial light, like mm-hmm. our crappy sleep habits, like the fact that nobody eats very well or gets any kind of vigorous exercise throughout the day. All of these things are, you know, they're in the mix. They're in that spreadsheet of factors that are contributing toward overall state of mind, including at times for certain individuals, a depressed state of mind. And that's the other big piece of this. This is why this is such a sort of it's a big question that covers a lot of ground, because of course certain personalities will respond to these kinds of social inputs differently, and so there is sort of a personality that we could say is more predisposed to depression.
It's the
same kind of failure feedback will not affect two people the same way. It will affect different people very differently depending on their essential temperament. It's just that those people who have that temperament that is more prone to malaise, depressiveness, those people would not have been able to wallow in it in really any previous generation. And you see that reflected in literature, you see it reflected in, the great myths all over the place, where there are always people who, if you plop them down in the modern era, they're going to be, you know, chronically dealing with this issue and not feeling a lot of success and not pursuing a lot of these kinds of things that we're talking about that might move the needle for them if they are able to exist in that condition. It's not a temperament that's new to the modern environment, but it just would not have been able to perseverate in depression in any other period of history, not in the same way that you can now. So And then the question is really asking, you know, can you change your state? There was something in the question, I forget exactly what they said, but is there a way you can kind of snap out of it, bootstrap yourself into a more positive mood state? And I think what we're saying is maybe short term you can do that, but fundamentally, you know, these feelings and these emotions are reflecting a state of failure feedback that, unless you take action on the source of that failure feedback and change the reason that you would be getting that feedback at all, it's going to come back. It's going to be a game of whack-a-mole with these emotions. But you definitely can sort of, you know, look at Tony Robbins, for example, or other motivational speakers who you can sort of psych yourself up and get yourself into a different state temporarily that might give you a little more sense of self-efficacy going into your day. And that might be something that helps you take a chance that you might not otherwise take, or engage in a social interaction that you might not otherwise do, and instead just stay home and watch Netflix all day. And if you do those things, that can change your whole analysis of where, who you are and where you fit in the village. And so that's all very important to do. So if it takes pumping yourself up to do that and to kind of talk yourself into going out there and pushing those boundaries a little bit and getting some different kind of feedback into your life, then that can be a very useful strategy. But it in and of itself is not going to change your perspective on the world long term.
Wow.
Yeah. We could talk, you know, for probably hours about this. Let me give you all kinds of things. So a good thing to do is to talk to somebody who's might be capable of helping you solve the problem that you have. So for example, you $75 and sign up with me if you're depressed and you're feeling like you got nowhere to go and don't know what to do. Believe me, I can figure out a hell of a lot to be done in half an hour. And so as a result, you're likely to feed. I'm not trying to talk any inspiration into you. Probably, I'm going to be able to find the root of your. Essentially, I'm going to find what tooth is really hurting the most, and then we're going to look at that, and we're going to see what competitive problem is it that you are stymied by. And we're going to look hard at what fundamentals are that you have or have not actually mastered sufficiently in order to be competitive. What is this? Okay, and there's a whole bunch of things that can be the cause of you feeling demoralized. But remember, the fundamental root of the depression is a discrepancy between what you're achieving and what you think you should reasonably be able to achieve. I'm not depressed because I'm not Jack Nicklaus or Tony Robbins or Joe Montana. I wouldn't expect to have competed with those people in those domains. So I'm competing with my local, reasonably similar competitors. That's who I'm competing for esteem with. And if I'm depressed, it's because I'm not achieving that esteem acquisition at a level that I would have thought that I should be able to. That's what's going to be causing depression. And so it might be the love or admiration or affection or attraction of a specific individual. At which point you need a big brother telling you, hey, you can't have all the candy in the store, and just because it makes sense to you doesn't mean it makes sense to them. What the hell are you thinking? Okay? And so, you know, there's a depression. I'm particularly, there's sort of two great sources of depression. One of them is going to be failure feedback, being demoralized, needing new inputs, okay? Because new inputs is going to alter the CBs on all kinds of things. And that's what Jen's talking about. But Jen's also saying something else. And that is that there are a percentage of people who are extremely, essentially, emotionally fragile to particularly the modern environment set of circumstances that will lead them. It's pretty easy for them to wander into the swamp, okay? And that's not true for most people. So, but it's true for enough people that the psychodynamic therapist can essentially make a career out of, you know, 15 of these people and just keep them their whole lives. But at any rate, we could, like I said, we could keep rolling. But there's anything that would enter into your mind that would alter your CB on your situation could be useful. Sometimes people have been depressed and morose, and then almost accidentally somebody attractive flirts with them a little bit, and it just lights them right back up. Why? Because the center was the inferences that they were making as a result of a romantic rejection, and it was getting them demoralized. So, but alternative to that, there would be we could be systematic and ruthless about attacking the source of that depression. And the thing is that when I do this clinically, it's very effective because what I am also doing is I'm kicking aside some of the childlike whining poor me, which is actually a strategy for whining our way to some resources out of the village that we've been treated unfairly, and that's why we failed. And as Jen knows, I don't put up with that. So we immediately are talking adult to adult. And so I'm more gentle if I feel like the person is more demoralized and more rattled and more depressed and not as resilient. However, there is still a quiet, relentless patience with the fact that the reason why you are depressed is that, you know, there is a discrepancy between your personal estimation of how things ought to reasonably be for you and how they are. And then there's a logical relationship between that distinction. And therefore, there are then steps that we would take, that we would analyze, that are, you know, that there is some 1,000-step journey or a 10-step journey or a 3-step journey, but whatever there is, there are reasons for that discrepancy. And if those reasons are, if there's anything that you can do about those reasons, then our job is to start doing them. And we approach that process with the attitude and the social feedback from me or Jen is that, hey, we don't know what the hell is going to happen, i.e., our attitude is anti-ego trap. It's like we're going to learn something, but this is the most logical course of action. Okay, so now that starts changing, likely, the cost-benefit analysis that was sitting inside that person's head before I started talking to him. Okay?
In most cases, not in all cases.
Oh, not in all cases. And as Jen,
we have some holdouts.
Of course we're going to have some holdouts, and we know who they are.
And they usually don't call us a second time.
They're not
getting what it is that they're fishing for from us.
That's right.
And so we usually, we don't. None of you who are listening are those people. Don't worry about that. The little high conscientious nutcases are all like, are they talking about me? No, we're not talking about you.
No.
We're talking about people who have no interest in taking any action on any of these things that we point out to them as, you know, the fire in their living room that they need to put out to feel better. So I'm having trouble breathing because of all the smoke in my living room.
Yeah.
You put out the fire in your living room. maybe leave it first and then put out the fire. But yes, you have to have an honesty, an essential sort of level of honesty and self-responsibility and willingness to take action. And of course, by definition, these are going to be almost certainly difficult and uncomfortable frontiers of action, or you would have done them already. So it's the question of when you run up against that, when somebody points it out, you know, and we're not brutal about it, but
no.
when we sort of illuminate this or help people understand what it is, you know, for most people that will be a relief. It'll be like, oh my gosh, I have the keys to the kingdom here. I really can, if I do this, I can see how I, you know, not only will my life improve, but because my life improves, I will feel better. Mm-hmm. And so there's that intersection there where there are some people who don't want to move in that direction. They just want to complain, essentially.
They're looking for resources in a fashion other than being more competitive in the domain. And so that if that is what they're doing, then we are not the place. The place is, you know, I don't know.
your grad school colleague.
Siggy Freudenberger down the street. Go talk to him.
Yeah.
All right. All right, Nathan, let's go on to the next one.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I know you guys have talked endlessly about depression and kind of those three domains, and it's always nice to hear you guys wind out on this in this topic. It's so different than what other therapists or even what we hear in normal kind of pop culture about. You just have to, you know, turn things around and you just have to think positive, and it's really so action oriented.
Or worse, that there's some chemical imbalance. Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah, worse
we,
yet.
We just have to fix the chemical imbalance with this pill and then you'll be right as rain.
Yep.
And it's usually a combination of that when people feel that, oh, well, yeah, the drugs fixed me for a while, but now I'm back, doc, because now my depression's back. It's like, oh, well, now we'll change your dose, but also, yeah, you just need to think positive. I've told the story many times of the therapist who some college counselor who, in addition to trying to medicate me, chasing me out into the waiting room, you know, are you sure I can't write you a script for an antidepressant? They also, their big piece of advice to me when I was trying to get over a breakup, I was devastated by this breakup, and I reported, I just can't stop thinking about the guy. She said, well, why don't you try a day of just not thinking about it?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
This is the best they've got.
Yeah, this,
like, that's great advice.
You know, I would actually say some more about this. I mean, we're going to talk about this and probably in more detail at our shindig in Virginia next month.
But definitely.
There is a really understandably interesting confusion about the relationship between unconscious processes and conscious processes. And the notion is that conscious processes can have some way of which they superimpose themselves onto unconscious processes, i.e. snap out of it, think positive, et cetera. You know, watch your thoughts, because when they're negative and self-downing, we have to stop that and correct that. This is all a spectacular misunderstanding about the mind's function and how this architecture works. What is in consciousness is a small percentage of the unconscious process. It is not an independent process. It is part of that process. Okay, so your and all of it is automated. So you don't have a choice as to what you think. Okay, there is no such choice. Your mind is constantly searching for optimum payoffs with respect to gene survival problems. That's what it does. If you wanted to try to get yourself to sit and contemplate the difference between cinnamon and oregano for the next 16 hours straight, you couldn't do it. Okay? Your mind would be wandering all over the place, because it would be saying, this is not worthy of the time and energy that would be involved to do this. You can't sit there, as OCD as you are, you can't sit there in front of the orange juice counter and spin for 5 hours deciding whether it's Tropicana or Minute Maid. You can't do it. Even if you're OCD, you can't do it. If you're OCD, you might do it for 15 minutes, okay? Whether you're OCD or not, or a normally functioning brain, your brain is unconsciously triaging all of the options that your existence has, and it's running a cost-benefit analysis on all of them, including the direction or the how much energy should be put mentally, time and energy should be put into thinking about whatever problem that you're thinking about. Okay? That's why, quote, time heals all wounds. Because if you've had something catastrophic or traumatic or whatever the hell happened, and it's been pretty upsetting and it's been a big catastrophic loss, what's going to happen is that your brain understands the translation of the gene survival loss that it took on with this boy, okay, for example. And the brain basically says, okay, how important was that loss? What does this mean? What was the competitive deficiency? What did we do? What we could have said differently? How close were we to not losing this? In other words, it does a Monday morning quarterbacking film study of the relationship, your presentation, the interactions, the data, the loss, but it does this in context of everything else in your life. You know, so a few term papers have been turned in late and downgraded, or some people even took a chunk down in their class and, you know, got one whole lower grade because of some breakup. But a hell of a lot of people didn't, because it depended upon what the value of the breakup was and how catastrophic the whole thing was, et cetera, et cetera. So we certainly can't choose to not think about the damn thing. That isn't a possibility. The brain is going to triage it. However, if we were in a Stone Age situation and we had to keep pushing forward to get fed, guess what? We couldn't have blown off, quote, I'm not going to write that paper. I'm just going to let my grades go to shit. Not possible. You'll be hungry at 5:30 this evening and nobody's going to help you. Maybe the little lady in the tent next to you will help you for a couple of days, and then she's going to say, that's all, honey. Okay, that's it. And you're going to have to start digging potatoes just like everybody else. So, but the modern world, and I'm not really frustrated with it, I understand how confusing this has been for people and for psychologists. You know, academic psychology probably barely knows this themselves. I mean, most of academic psychology has got its head in the sand, doesn't even understand that that psychology is a subset of biology. You say that to 10, 50 psychology professors, I wonder what they would say back. Okay, they don't like the sound of that, but it is. It's obviously what it is. And we should no more be upset about that than a nephrologist says we're a subcomponent of medicine. Of course you are, for God's sakes. Okay? Well, psychology is a subset of biology. And so the mind, you know, the quote conscious mind, like if you look, watch carefully, I've got all kinds of things going on in my unconscious mind, and I'm calculating all kinds of stuff. And yet I'm going to say something three sentences from now that is germane to what it is that we're talking about. I don't know what that sentence is going to be. I will find out when you find out, which tells you I didn't, quote, consciously figure out what to say, and you're not actually listening to a stream of consciousness. You're listening to a stream of unconsciousness. Okay? So when we try to, like, say things in the mirror and say things out loud, and I had somebody wrote a question about binge eating and saying something out loud, and that's supposed to program or stop me from doing this. This is all ludicrous. These are fanciful concepts. What the only thing that's going to change how you think, feel, and behave is not going to be what you recite or what you say or you don't say, or what you, quote, you think that you can stop your brain from thinking things or not. You can't stop anything of the kind. The only thing that's going to alter the trajectory of your experience is going to be new information. Okay? And that new information, if it's going to alter the situation, it's going to be germane to the issue that you're dealing with. Okay? So therefore, we need to seek that information from people who are likely to be expert. And in this case, a hell of a lot of people suffering has to do with the features of your life are radically enough different than the Stone Age environment that it's setting you up for vulnerabilities with respect to your esteem dynamics. Okay? And so we're going to be like Alan Goldhammer. If you come to the center, he's going to ask you all kinds of things about what it is that you do, what your behavior is, what your relationship is to your body and your environment. And he's not just necessarily going to be pointing to one thing. He's going to look at the whole thing and realize, you know what, you got all kinds of health problems, and we need to take you back to the Stone Age. And if we take you back to the Stone Age, all kinds of things are going to resolve. And one of the classic things at the center, or when Nathan was doing Fasting Escape there, you could do it at home with Nathan now. But the point is that you see comprehensive changes in the body as all kinds of things improve, not one thing, not the one thing you're worried about. So the the modern prescriptions are, you know, generally, whether it comes from a great deal of cognitive therapy, is incredibly obtuse. And certainly psychodynamic therapy is worthless. Psychopharmacology is worthless. What's worthwhile? Joe the bartender is better than most therapy. Okay. And a decent friend is pretty good, i.e. just because you've lost and you're embarrassed, you haven't lost me as a coalition member. That's what Carl Rogers did for psychotherapy. Just became like a friend, a really patient, nice friend. That was pretty good. Actually, people felt better. That's what a lot of times passes for, quote, a good therapist today is somebody that's like that. And I'm not like that. Jen is. But anyway, the point is, what will ultimately change? So, you know, your mind can change if that's where you're hurting, because you're feeling a little isolated, a little lonely, and a little rejected, and a little embarrassed. And if you have a, quote, a good therapist that says, hey, you're fine. You know what I mean? I don't see anything. I think you're blah, blah. And they give you realistic and positive feedback about who you are. That can be very helpful. And that therapist doesn't have to know anything about EP. They're just a good human being with some good, you know, with some good intuition and some good social skill. Okay? And they can be more patient with you about the inferences that you're making about some of the negative feedback that you've had, and said, no, I think you're overgeneralizing that. Now we start sounding like a cognitive therapist. But we can do even better. Okay, we can break this down to the nuts and bolts of the deep competitive problem that we're even oftentimes afraid to admit that exists. Okay, you don't see cognitive therapy talking about competition in your life. You see them saying, well, you just have to give yourself self-esteem. Who cares what everybody thinks? And you just got to have it. The secret to that is to have your thinking about yourself independent of what anybody else thinks. Ah, they just stepped into la-la land. Okay, that's a fantasy. Your emotional life is highly dependent upon the feedback that you receive from other people, because that's endemic to your biology. Okay, so that's why what we do here has a very different angle to it. And so, you know, think of it in those terms, and seek us out for help if you need it.
I think it's great, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk. It's so amazing, because, like, with a nephrologist, for example, they can't really cut open into their own kidneys and diagnose themselves or do these things. With you, with this approach, if you feel depressed or if something's going on, you can actually find out exactly what's going on. And so it kind of leads me to think that the person who told Jen, who told you, oh, just don't try not to think about this. It's like, have they ever, they've clearly never even felt that way before, and then tried not to think about it. Just kind of fantasy land for them.
Well, she just didn't know anything else to tell me, you know.
Right.
She was just drawing from the toolkit of half Rogerian, half maybe some CBT, i.e. question the irrational thought.
Right.
And she thought she was being as helpful as she could, even though she probably was experiencing that feeling that I felt when I was an astrologer, which is that you're giving bad advice that you don't really believe. Yeah. And it's not a very good feeling. You don't look forward to going to work. You feel like a fraud, because you are. And, you know, she wasn't entirely a fraud. She was,
right.
She was helpful as far as she could be, but she had a limited toolkit. So, I mean, I'll put in a brief, yeah. Just a brief word for the parts of CBT and even mindfulness meditation type practices that can be useful. It's you know, everything that Doug is saying is true. The thoughts are not coming out of nowhere. You know, they're not, they're representing a reality that is trying to get your attention for good reason. And so you can't change you can't change the origin of the thoughts without fundamentally changing your reality, which is, you know, we have the whole thing actually upside down when we think of, you know, change your thoughts, change your reality. But what you can do is you can develop, and this goes back to the personality question, where some people have noisier brains than other people. Some people have this, you know, internal chatter dialed up to 11 in a way that other people don't. A lot of that is emotional stability and high conscientiousness and just other personality factors. And so in that case, mindfulness practice, which I'm more familiar with than the ins and outs of CBT, but I think there's a lot of overlap. It's useful in developing a different perspective on the chatter. So it doesn't change the chatter, but it does give you a little bit of a buffer from it. And what my personal experience in meditation is that you make, in the language of meditation, you make friends with the monkey mind. And so you start to develop this sort of almost amusement at how rapidly your thinking of things, and you go from thinking about choosing which orange juice you're going to order to suddenly you're thinking of something that happened when you were in second grade and you know, you had an interaction with a bully on the schoolyard playground, and then you're back to the orange juice, and then you're thinking about something that's happening at work tomorrow, and it's just all over the place. And if you were cultivating over time a meditation practice to kind of observe that situation and watch those thoughts firing around your head, and you can get into that position of the witness where you're watching the thoughts, and you practice this skill of not attaching to any particular thought. Yes, maybe it has some importance and salience for what's going on in your life, but for now, for these 20 minutes when we've set this timer, we're just going to let it go and we're going to let the next thought come. It gives you some independence from the storm. It just gives you a little bit of a feeling that you don't have to get carried away with every little thought that comes into your head. You don't have to take action on every single thing that occurs to you in real time. You can sit there and let it wash over you and pass away, and then another thought comes. And that can be an incredibly beneficial practice for some people, if they do it right.
You know, Jen, I've just thought about this recently. I had this guy asked me a question. I lectured at the center yesterday just for fun. I was out there a couple of days ago. And that, you know, I think that what that is a triage. So I think that what meditation is the, let's start with what we know it isn't and what anybody might think it is. There is no such thing as blanking the mind. It is not impossible. So let me
explain. Right. That's not what it asks you to do, just
I understand.
In its defense, but yes.
Right. So what we do, notice that you're not going to be meditating if there's a bunch of noises and evidence, smells from the room that are demanding your attention. Okay. So your brain is still running the same CB that it always does. And so if we put ourselves in a quiet place, then, and we're going to meditate, what we're allowing to happen is that we're shutting down the urgency of sensory inputs. So we're quieting down a major source of inputs that is usually hitting the mind as it's doing its triage, and it's always triaging. So by doing that, we've essentially reduced the workload on the mind. And now what it's able to do, now as we sit there, we can actually watch components of the triage process. Now, it's useful for people to know that you are only watching an infinitesimally small fraction of it. That in fact, there are 2 million data bits that are being processed every second in that head. But what you will have, it's interesting that you would say things like the orange juice and then the bully and then the this and that. It's like how the brain is organized around memory circuitry and the triage process are fantastically complex. So there could have been something about the thinking about the orange juice decision that actually was somehow related to the bully on the playground. Maybe he had orange hair.
Oh, totally. Oh, it almost certainly is.
Yeah.
But it's coming up in rapid fire, and it feels right. Like this disjointed, you know,
right.
I can't calm down. I'm just thinking, I'm just all over the place kind
right.
of feeling. And this is what, you know, you can get a little bit of quiet from.
Yes. And what I was going to say is I've never really thought through why some people would find this useful, but now I'm starting to, and that is that I think that the triage process, if you say to yourself for the next 20 or 30 minutes, I am not going to, in other words, suppose you've got a list of 150 things on this that you have to do between now and next Tuesday because you got a wedding or whatever the hell it is. And it's disorganized, disjointed. The brain is unconsciously organizing the hell out of it. It's constantly trying to triage. And one of the things that it's aware of is that it is certain that it does not have the optimum sequence. Okay, there's too many things that are changing in real time about 150 items on that sequence. And so as a result, it's struggling as it does its triage, but it's brilliant at it. That's why it has a 2 trillion bit per second calculator, is that it can do an incredible amount of computations to figure out what's in its best interest. However, there are times when, and we've all been here, where it's like, okay, instead of me trying to frantically get some things done on this list, what I really need to do is to step aside, get everything written down on the list, and look at that list and see what my order should be for the next 10 things. And the other 140 things are going to have to scratch. And so it turns out that there is value in the process of taking time out to triage. And that is what meditation is going to allow that process to take place. And the triaging that it's going to do is going to be super complicated. It's not going to be your list of things for the bank and the corporate logo. It's going to be actually about your life writ large. Okay? And so by formally giving this space and having essentially an agreement that the unconscious brain, you know, calculates and agrees with it, okay, this might be a wise experiment for us to do, is to allow this triage process to take place. Shut down sensory inputs, quiet this whole thing down, and let's just find out if we give it a little time, you know, essentially catch up on the triaging where we are constantly behind, essentially because we've got hyper-conscientiousness and a complex life, okay? If you've got hyper-conscientiousness, a little bit of instability and a complex life, I can almost guarantee that you feel harried in that life. So I think this, how does that, what I'm trying to get at is two things that I'm trying to answer. Why anybody would ever do it? And an answer is, it's not a conscious choice to meditate. You learned about its possibilities, you were open enough to experiment with it, and then you discovered that you got some value of it that you can't even put your finger on, okay? That value had to ultimately be related to gene survival, and I will argue that the value that comes out of that is going to be a triage accuracy. And we're often going to find out that triage accuracy, the improvement of the triage accuracy, is going to result in some relaxation to the system as it now goes forward with a little bit more confidence about what its priorities should be. This is my sort of off the cuff but principled analysis as to why this would happen, and in other cases, why it wouldn't happen with other personalities that don't have the hyper-conscientiousness that causes the frenetic calculation and OCD-like ruminating over things because they don't have the instability or the hyper-conscientiousness that is worried about embarrassing downsides or other things.
Dr. Lyle, it's reminding me of when I was brainstorming Fasting Escape, because I remember talking to you. I remember after a podcast we talked and said, I just have too many thoughts, it's all. And you said, go get a cork board and make a war room for yourself.
Ah, that's right.
And that's what I did, exactly what you just described. And within 3 weeks, right, I had the whole plan all. I just had post-it notes, putting everything up all. And exactly, triaging is exactly the word, how it worked, is I just wrote every little idea that ever came to mind for a few weeks, and then it all started coming together, and then figured out how it was going to work.
Right. And so yours was an example of that you aren't naturally that way, but the risk and the issues involved and the moving parts involved were overwhelming your normal functioning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And what do you think, Jen? What do you think about this?
If it's triaging, it's working at a secondary level that's not consciously available to the practitioner. Because
right,
when you're sitting there on the cushion and you're meditating, your specific instructions are to not sit there and try to think through your to-do list, or to try to, you know, organize your thoughts in any kind of way, or say, yeah, oh, well, that thought's more important than that thought, and so I'm going to set that aside, or I'm going to jot it down on this notebook so I can come back to it later. You're very explicitly not supposed to do that. Everything is, you know, and it's just a cloud passing across the sky, no matter how important it is, no matter how much urgency it seems mm-hmm. to have. So you're sort of cultivating the opposite of triage, where everything has equal value. And you know, when you say you can't quite put your finger on the value, I think I can. The value for me is that you have this feeling of, the word you'll hear all the time in Buddhist circles is spaciousness. There's a spaciousness that comes into your decision making when you're in a situation later, days later, weeks later, and this comes with regular practice. It doesn't happen immediately the next day. So this is a quality that is practiced and cultivated over time through this, you know, very specific designated practice, that you do begin to have. I always use the analogy of it's Neo in the Matrix dodging the bullets. You feel like you have more time between when somebody says something irritating and you have to respond to it. There's this buffer that comes into your awareness and this ability to, in that moment, triage. Do I need to take action on this? Do I need to respond to this in my habitual way? You get this extra little nanosecond of time to look at that from a different perspective, and it is very sort of mystical. It's something that, you know, I probably didn't start to have that feeling until after a couple of months of regular practice, and it's subtle, but it's makes a very big difference when you have a lot of noise in your head, if you are that kind of person or you're going through that period, that kind of time in your life.
Yeah, I hear you, but I think I've penetrated the mysticism. I think this is what it is. Okay. And the reason is you couldn't do it unless it was answering to a CB. You wouldn't. Okay. Nobody would ever meditate. They wouldn't do it.
Well, there's lots of other good CB. I mean, there's the social benefits.
Oh,
there's,
yeah,
the cute guy in your meditation
group. Okay.
There's the virtue signaling that you get from putting a little meditation emoji next to your name on Twitter. Like, you know, it's lots of good CBs there.
Right,
but
right.
But there's the actual practice also has this, you know. I mean, I definitely was not feeling like it was immediately very beneficial for the first several weeks that I did it. Even doing it pretty intensively. It came with time.
Right. But that makes sense. I mean, all of that actually makes sense to me from this perspective. So we get rid of all the social psychological whiz bang, and we have somebody that has some very high conscientiousness issues that would drive complexity and potentially error in triage. And then we put that person into a situation where they're open enough to invest in a process, and in that process they wind up carrying around essentially an improved triage in their head, which enables them to have slightly different reactions than they would have had under certain circumstances. Makes sense to me.
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, I remember reading Baumeister's book about willpower, and I got the impression there that if you do anything sustained consistently where you're delaying, you know, instant gratification, then it actually helps to delay instant gratification with all domains of your life long-term, as long as you keep doing it.
Yeah, I don't trust him.
Oh, okay.
I don't trust him. He's not that smart.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No, he's talking way past. He's talking hopeful Henry and no evidence. No, I don't think so. I think that... I think, you know, we Jen and I are going to talk. This is the first time Jen and I have ever had this conversation, and this is it's actually an interesting thing for the two of us to explore and to think through, because she has done it and she knows there's benefits to it, and she sort of knows about the process of how it is that she's doing it. So, but a lot of her knowledge about it is right brain, and whenever I smell anybody that is. Made an investment and is doing something, I know there's a reason why they're doing it. And she's not doing it to show off. Okay, so she's actually...
I was at first.
Oh, yeah, there you...
I mean, that was absolutely, know, there were components of that. I'm not going to deny that. But yeah, that's not why I do it, you know, privacy of my own home. It's probably why I'm talking about it here.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a little chip in there.
But no, I mean, I continue the practice invisibly and in a non-social process, because it continues. I feel strong subjective benefit from it.
Yes. Yes. And... Yeah, and you and I, when I get back to Virginia, we'll talk deeply about, you know, what we can uncover about what that is. That's a worthy discussion. Yeah. Fabulous. All right, Nathan. Well, we got one question done, which is kind of how it is that we do things around here.
Yeah.
One question with many, many tendrils. Yeah.
Yes. I actually I was reading down through a few of the questions, and there are a bunch of good questions we have lined up. So I thought we were going to get to five or six of them today, but hey, this was a really good question. It was worth doing.
Well, next week we've got, so this question was great because it really shows our listeners the applications of evolutionary psychology on a very real world problem like depression. And so next question is going to be about when people are kind of bastardizing that and how evolutionary psychology has been useful or has been used, improperly. And it's going to be a question about eugenics. And so, so we'll talk about that, in the next show. But in the meantime, we're only three shows away from the seminar, the True to Life seminar. So I encourage all the listeners to go to www.truetolife.us, excuse me, truetolife.us, so that you guys can register for the True to Life seminar that's coming up February 19th. But yeah, we'll get through these five questions over the next three shows. But
we will. Yeah. Yeah. All good. All right, Nathan, Jen, any other thoughts or what are we thinking? Anything else?
No, I think we're good. We'll shut it down.
Got it. All good. Jen goes back and faces the 30-degree weather. I face 50-degree weather, and Nathan faces 70-degree weather, but whatever. But we're all going to Jen's in a few weeks.
That's right. It'll be nice and toasty warm in mid-February for you.
You got it.
How many jackets should I bring?
A few
California jackets, probably three, but one Virginia jacket. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Definitely.
All right, everybody.
All right. Have a good night, everyone.
Talk next time.
All right. Bye. Thank you, Nathan. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.